Welcome, everybody. This is the ARPSC first online technician licensing class. We're going to have several different instructors for the five classes we've planned. And my name is Dave Jordan, and the call is WA3GIN. And if you're all logged onto the system, or if you have the hard copy in front of you, you're now looking at the first presentation slide, lesson one. And I'm going to go ahead and advance the slide. Should take a few seconds to change for those of you that are online. If somebody wants to confirm they have seen the slide change, that would be good. You should be looking at FCC rules sub-element T1. There's not much to this slide. We start off real light in the beginning. Basically, we're going to go over an introduction of the rules and regulations for the first level of licensing that the FCC provides for citizens of the United States who would like to get amateur radio licensed. You should be looking at a slide now that says, why amateur radio? Is that up on your screen, Desiree?
Yeah, it was just coming up.
Okay, good.
With my, unfortunately, with my dial-up, it's slow.
All right, so it's building.
But it's there now. Thank you.
Very good. All right. So let's go over, and by the way, everything we talk about here this evening, and as well as the other four classes, you will find elements of this information on the exam. The basis and the purpose for amateur radio service consists of five basic principles. And again, remember, amateur radio started many, many years ago, so some of the terminology and some of the basis is going to be mid-century thinking, so don't be surprised if some of the language seems a little old-fashioned. The FCC is not under pressure to upgrade its terminology, so over the decades, a lot of the stuff has not changed. Anyhow, the first part of it, and again, when you talk about ham radio, you will remember that we are transmitting signals now around the planet, so it's not just an activity that takes place in your neighborhood or in your state or in the United States, but when you're transmitting, you could be heard in Europe or in Asia. So the government has a real interest in making sure that when it allows someone in the U.S. to become a basically a shortwave broadcast station, that they are not going to become an embarrassment to the country. So, initially, recognition and enhancement of the value of amateur radio service to the public as an emergency communications, which is the reason many of you signed up for this class, as a volunteer, non-commercial communication service, particularly with respect to, again, emergency communications. Continuation and extension of the amateur radio's proven ability to contribute to the advancement of the radio art. Again, back in the 30s, radio was really what the internet is today. It was the magical technology of the time. And in fact, if you talk to any person who has tried to line up a wireless microwave antenna, they will admit to you that the radio is still art when it comes to trying to get those signals to connect between devices. So, third, encouragement and improvement of amateur service through rules which provide for advancing skills in both communications and in the technical phases of the art. So you're going to learn regulations, the FCC regulations. You're going to also learn basic electronics, basic electricity. And as you advance through the different licenses, if you choose to do so, you will continue to advance in your understanding of the basic principles of electronics. I've just hit the slide where you're now looking at why amateur radio continued. The fourth element is the expansion of the existing reservoir within amateur radio service of trained operators, technicians, and electronics experts. Again, remember 70 years ago, there weren't that many folks who really were comfortable with and understood the technology that we call radio. Pre-television days, of course, radio was the method for broadcasting to the population, so it was a big deal back then. Not such a big deal now. Everything about radio is taken for granted. All our cell phones and Blackberries, of course, are all based on advanced radio technology, but it's still radio. And lastly, the continuation and extension of amateur radio's unique ability to enhance the international goodwill. And that's a real important one, and you will find out very quickly if you advance in your licensing and start talking to folks in Europe and other parts of the world, that if you start becoming extremely outrageous with your commentary, you will no doubt get a visit or at least a letter or a call from the Federal Communications Commission. So that is one area where the commission is still very much engaged. As a matter of fact, just today, a fellow up in New England was fined $21,000 because he didn't respond to a letter from the FCC asking about his operations over the past year or so. So it can happen. Next slide, you're looking at a picture of a couple ladies there operating what looks like in the field. I see what looks like a tent cover and some trees in the background. This is probably an exercise that they're participating in. And what we're talking about on this slide is the different types of licensing currently available in the U.S. The very first entry-level license is the one we are talking about this evening, the technician class. That will be followed by a technician with Morse code. By the way, always capitalize Morse when you write Morse down. And that's what is also referred to as carrier wave transmissions, or CW. It's a different language. If you have an iPod and you want to program it in C, they've actually set it up so that it will take Morse code input to program the iPod. So there are still uses for Morse code even today. The next class up is general. That is the class of license which gives you a real wide spectrum of frequencies to use in the HF range. And it also allows you to run significant amounts of power up to 1.5 kW. And then there is the amateur extra class, which is the most advanced class technically. We're going to go over a sort of a broad brush of amateur radio tonight. This is sort of your introduction class. We're not going to explain a whole lot in detail about the things we're talking about. You will have questions. Those questions, for the most part, will be answered in future classes. But we're just trying to give you sort of an immersion into the topic this evening. All right, we're on amateur radio licenses continued. The FCC is the only entity in the U.S. who can extend a license to you. You get a primary station license before you can operate. You are responsible for that license. The FCC wants to know where you live, how they can contact you. In the event that something happens at your station, they want to be able to reach you. And they have a pretty extensive website now, and once you take your test, within probably days, the information for your license will be posted on the website, and from that point in time, you can start transmitting, even though you don't have your physical paper license in hand. The terms of the license are 10 years currently. Again, you've got a few rules to follow for expiration. There's a grace period, and if you are, you will be able to, for example, get a vanity call sign, like you get a vanity license plate. If you forget to renew, you will still have an opportunity to maintain that call sign. Call sign is what we use to define the license number that is issued to you by the FCC. So, if you're going to think about the test coming up in 6 or 7 weeks, you're going to remember things like the term of the license, the expiration grace period, and the renewal form. They might ask you something like, is Form 605 the form you would use for renewals and changes? So these are the kinds of things you want to make sure. You just have to memorize some of this stuff. There's no way around it. Okay, we'll move on to the next slide. This next slide is titled VHF, UHF Amateur Bands. VHF standing for very high frequencies and UHF for ultra high frequencies. Again, because transmissions of radio signals is a global experience, we have to interact with our other neighbors around the globe. That work is done in the International Telecommunications Union, which is a branch of the United Nations. The offices for the ITU are in Geneva. If you ever get there, you can stop by. They have a massive, massive amateur radio station there. And many of the delegates that go to work at the ITU working on things like calling card standards, or they might be working on GSM standards. Many of the telecommunications industry standards are developed there, and there are up to about 300 countries that would participate. The ITU has Section 4 amateur radio, because most countries allow licenses to constituents that want to operate this spectrum of frequencies. For your technician license, this is listed under this slide. So you have several bands of operation. If you look, mostly in the VHF and UHF spectrum. And again, you may not know what a meter is. The MHZ there stands for megahertz. We'll go into that downstream so you will understand what these things stand for. This is just to give you an idea of the different parameters. Some of you may have come across this stuff before. So 6 meters is sort of the in-between band. It's right on the edge of what we call high frequencies and very high frequencies. When you get into 2 meters, you're definitely talking about high frequencies. 144 megahertz is just a little bit higher than your standard FM broadcast frequencies, which run around 89 to 107 megahertz. You're all familiar with that on your stereo. Well, as you go further up, you will find a frequency in there that's for the aircraft communications, and then as you go further up even still, you will run into this amateur radio frequency. The next band up from that is 1.25 meters, 220 megahertz, and so on, 420 to 450 megahertz. Now you're starting to get into areas where there are some public broadcasts or public safety communications up in the 450 plus area. Anytime there's a gap between these bands, it doesn't mean no one's using it. It just probably means that these are licensed areas, licensed spectrum. And you look at the 33 centimeter band, of course, 900 megahertz, just below 902 megahertz. In the 850 to 900 range is where a lot of the cell phone frequencies are located, and also a lot of the public safety radio systems are located. And even higher, now you get up into the 1.2 gig, or as they have written it down here, 1240 megahertz. So these are really ultra-high frequencies. And then the last one, the 13 centimeter band, again, you get up to the 2.4 gigahertz. This is where you start seeing uses like your wireless laptops. 802.11 is probably something you hear and you're familiar with if you're really into wireless laptops. That operates around this 2.4 gigahertz frequency band. Moving on to the next slide. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the HF bands. Frequency limits for technician operators with Morse code in ITU Region 2. Again, later on in this presentation, we'll show you where Region 2 is, but you can probably guess where it's at. Here we go with the 80-meter band. Again, now we're not looking at megahertz now. These are much lower frequencies, 3,675,000 hertz or 3.675 megahertz. These frequencies are just above your AM broadcast band, which would be 1. I guess the highest frequency in the AM band would be 1.7 megahertz, or 1700 on your AM dial. So 80 meters, 40 meters, 15, and 10 meters are the most popular HF frequencies. 80 meters is pretty much a band where the frequencies will support skip conditions around 200 or 300 or 400 miles regularly. As you go up in frequency in the HF band, the signals tend to reach out further. For example, if you were to go on 40 meters this evening, you would probably be able to hear people in Indiana and Wyoming and perhaps Arizona, and as the evening got longer, California. 15 and 10 meters are the frequencies where you will see a lot of people operating across the continents, talking to Europe, talking to South Africa. Moving on to the next slide. Qualifying for a license. There will be questions about this on the test, so again, try and soak up this information. Anyone can become an amateur radio licensee except a representative of a foreign government. Last time I checked, that was still true. There's no minimum and no maximum age. We've seen 5-year-olds pass this test. We've seen 85-year-olds pass this test. So if a person's interested and capable, they will get the material and they can pass the test. Here we have a hint for you. Element 2 is the name of the test for a technician class license. They might even ask you that. What license can you get with Element 2? And they might give you a multiple choice question there. So 35 questions and I think a score of 75 gets you an FCC license. Any questions up to this point? All right, good. The next slide is testing. We have something called volunteer examiners. In the old days, when I took my test, I actually went down to the FCC headquarters one Saturday morning, and my dad took me down there, and we walked through these government hallways, and there was a big room with a bunch of chairs, and there was an old, mean-looking guy sitting up front with a paper tape punched machine that they would run this paper tape through this device. It would generate tones, and that's how you would take your CW exam. You had to have a proficiency of 13 words a minute back then for a general class license. And then you could also take the written exam. And if you didn't pass with a sufficient grade, you'd have to wait a month or so before you could come back and test it again. Some folks had to drive hundreds of miles to come in to take their test. Nowadays, the FCC has pushed that process out into the volunteer realm, and amateur radio operators are now providing that testing. So we have folks here in the Washington area, almost, I would say, at least every 2 weeks or so, there's a club offering testing within maybe 20 miles at least, if not closer. So easy to take a test these days. You pass your test, you will get a Certificate of Successful Completion of Examination, CSCE, is issued for each element. When you test for the Morse code element, which is element 1, it's very important that you keep that certificate. That's the only certificate you're going to get that proves that you passed that test, and you'll need it if you want to upgrade. All right, I've updated the slides. Should be building here shortly. Desiree, am I giving you enough time for the slides to build?
Yes, indeed you are. Thank you.
All righty, great. All righty, so the next slide here is more about testing. And you've got a CSCE for element 1. It's only valid for 365 days for upgrade purposes. So once you pass your code test, you've got basically a year to continue to study your theory if you want to upgrade to the next level. And I believe that's an accurate representation of that 365 days limit. A disabled applicant who may not be able to hear can still test for CW using either a vibrating surface or a flashing light, and I'm sure there are folks that have come up with other devices to help those folks that are disabled to want to take the test. Again, keep the CSCE in your important records file so that you will be able to use it in the event you want to upgrade. And this particular club, and the reason we're teaching this class here in Arlington County again, is to bring people towards that radio amateur civil emergency service volunteer work. And so we want to get you licensed for the UHF VHF stuff, but we also want you to continue on. Because, for example, if we want to hook up and talk to the State Emergency Operations Center, we're not going to be able to do that very easily using VHF or UHF. But it'd be a piece of cake using 80 meters, for example, HF. So the idea here is this is a starting point for everybody, not an end point. We might be a little aggressive in that mission, but that's what we are. We're a little bit aggressive in that mission. We want to have a crew of volunteers that have the maximum flexibility when it comes to emergency communications. Next slide, amateur radio call signs. Let's talk a little bit about that license number that you're going to get issued. You need to make sure that you identify yourself when you are transmitting on the air. And the typical frequency is 10 minutes. So if you're speaking to someone, you ought to attempt to identify yourself at least every 10 minutes. Sometimes you'll hear, as you get experience on some of these, what we call repeaters, which we will talk about in another class, folks will identify every time they get their turn to talk. That's not necessary. Just try and keep a sense of time and occasionally identify. You'll always be within the law. The FCC assigns call signs by the ITU prefix letters, a call district numeral, and a suffix in the alphabetic order. So, again, ITU has some control over the kinds of call signs that we issue here in the United States. There are actually guys out there and gals who enjoy trying to work every single country and collect all the different call signs. And so there's lots of contests out there, and they call these folks DXers for long distance. DX stands for long distance. And I know several that have, over the years, worked over 300 different countries. In the U.S., the call signs begin with the letter A, K, N, or W, and have a single digit, a digit between 0 and 9. My call sign is WA3GIN. That call sign is about over 40 years old, let's say. Dan just got a call sign recently. It's a vanity call. His call is K9SLY. There's a map coming up shortly which I'll explain where the number comes in, because there used to be a geographic reason for issuing the number. Okay, we're going to move on. We're building a slide now called More on Call Signs. Technician class operators receive a Group C and D format call. And that could be a 1x3 or a 2x3. My call, WA3GIN, is a 2x3. Two letters, followed by number, followed by three letters. It could also be like Dan's call, one letter, followed by a number, and then three letters. This is a great question to be on the test. So remember, Group C and D format calls, 1x3, 2x3. And again, you can request a special call sign. You'll pay a little bit for it. I think it's $14 is the current charge. It's good for 10 years. But for example, I could have a call sign K3DPJ, which would be my initials. The suffix would be my initials. Any FCC licensed amateur may request a special event call sign, which would be a 1x1. For example, K4E. if, let's say, we wanted to have a special exercise of emergency communications within Northern Virginia, and we wanted to promote that exercise, we could ask for a special edition call sign, could be K4E or something else, and they would issue that for a period of a week or 2 weeks, and then anyone who's licensed would be able to use that call sign during that period of time. So these are ways of generating interest in the hobby and increasing the enjoyment and the value of the hobby for the folks that are participating in special events. Moving on to the next slide, and here we finally get a picture of the United States call districts. If you look at the red states, you see there's a number 4 there. Years ago, the FCC did not give very much leeway into what you could do with your call sign. There was no such thing as a vanity call. If you lived in South Carolina and you passed your test, you got a call sign with a number 4. You would get something like WA4XYZ. If you moved to Wyoming, you would have to change your call sign. You would get a completely new call sign, K7XYZ, for example. You had no say as to what the call sign was going to be. That's changed over the years now. In fact, I'm here in Foreland in Virginia. I've kept my old WA3 call. I couldn't do that years ago, and to keep my WA3 call, I had to use my work address in Washington, which is in Three Land. We call it Three Land or Four Land or Five Land. You'll hear people say that on the radio. Oh, he's from Seven Land. Well, then, if you want to know where Seven Land is, you can look at them at this district map, and you can see. The same goes for the DX call signs. Now, there is one area under the U.S. call districts that is not on this map. And if somebody wants to send me an email with what that area is, they'll get extra credit for this class. So keep an eye on that map and see what you think. All right, let's move on. All right, we're moving over now to something we call common sense rules. These are general common sense rules when it comes to operating in the amateur radio world when you're broadcasting. One thing you never do is play music. The only folks that can play music on amateur radio are the astronauts. I don't know why that is, except I know traditionally they used to play music to wake them up in the morning, so that may be an offshoot from that, but that's the only area where amateur radio operators are allowed to have music transmitted. And I didn't know that one until I looked at this, because when I took the test, there were no astronauts, so this one's new. No payment may be accepted for your transmissions. For example, if someone has a message they'd like to get delivered to somebody, you can do that as a public service, but you can't take payment for it. Profanity and obscenity, of course, not allowed. We are trying to get younger folks involved in the hobby. There are young children within earshot of speakers on our transceivers. We sure don't want them being exposed to anything like that. So you will find occasionally there will be some groups who think they are have a right to be obnoxious, and they may be operating outside these common sense rules, but for the most part, everyone abides by these. You can't be sending any codes or ciphers. That, again, comes from the earlier days of the FCC, where they were worried about spies making transmissions. So, but that's still law, and it's required that we stick to those regulations. No false or deceptive signals may be transmitted either. don't see too much of that. Sometimes you'll read about someone interfering with transmissions of other operators, or perhaps interfering with Coast Guard transmissions. Sometimes they happen to be ham radio operators. If your license expires, you may no longer transmit. The ability to get the same call sign within 2 years doesn't mean you can keep transmitting for 2 years. It just means you can apply for the renewal. Once it expires, your transmitting days are over until you get the new license back in the mail. Okay, broadcasting, defined as transmissions intended for reception by the general public. Not allowed in amateur radio service. Sure, if you're like giving people the weather forecast, that's great, but just make sure you're talking to somebody about the weather rather than just firing up your transmitter and pretending you're the Today Show. Doesn't work on ham radio. All right, we moved over to slides now. It says sometimes we have to share. And what that means is we have some frequencies where amateur radio service is a secondary user. In other words, we can use those frequencies unless or if we are not interfering with the primary user. For example, on the 23 centimeter band, it's shared. If you're interfering with a radio location station outside the U.S., you have to stop operating or take steps to eliminate the interference. If two amateur radio stations want to use the same frequency, they each have equal rights to that frequency. Typically, it is rare that two people will try to use the same frequency exactly at the same time. Usually one person will hear the other person. The best operating practice is let the other person use the frequency, move off them, and find a new frequency that's clear. That's the best practice. It always works. Moving on to the next slide. Now we're looking at the International Telecommunication Union regions. Remember earlier we talked about Region 2? Well, now you can see Region 2, which encompasses Alaska, Canada, the United States, and a good portion down to all the way down to South America, and looks like part of Antarctica down there. And it's broken up into what looks like three regions. So someone might ask you what region you're operating in, and you could say Region 2. Now, if you are visiting another country, you may not be in Region 2 anymore. Of course, you could tell them then you're broadcasting from Region 1. There are paperwork and procedures that you have to follow if you decide you want to operate your station from another country. For the most part, it's doable, but you do have to start on the process early because it takes time. When we went to the ITU to work for the State Department, we were able to take our transmitters there and operate, and it was a lot of fun. Okay, going to the next slide. You're going to see, as it builds, a 70 centimeter band restriction along the border with Canada. This is going to be on the test, I guarantee it. Well, of course, a new test is coming out, but I bet you this one is still on there. If you look at it, it talks about frequency limits north of line A, 430 to 450 megahertz, versus 420 to 450 everywhere else. So there's that 10 megahertz chunk that they removed. And that's for a 50-mile band south of the Canadian border. And they do that so that we prevent interfering with I imagine it's the Mounted Police up there or something. They're using that frequency in Canada, and they don't want to get any interference from us. This is a fairly old one. I'm not even sure it's really an issue anymore, but it's still on the books, and it might be on the test. Next slide. You will see Amateur Space Station. And I don't, let's see, KC5OZX. I don't know who that is. I didn't look it up. So the regulation for this one is that to be an amateur radio space station, you have to be 50 kilometers above the Earth. I guess that's not an issue for folks yet, because unless you're working on the space station, you're probably not going to be up there in a private vehicle and having to determine if you're far enough out from the Earth to operate as a space station. But who knows, that'll probably become an issue down the road before too long. And they talk about being able to transmit unidentified communications. I'd have to have somebody define that one for me. It may mean that they're not required to do the 10-minute ID, although I think they probably will ID a lot, because there's a lot of folks down here that are listening for them and would like to talk to them. Okay, moving on to the next slide. This is part of our, I think, what the test format looks like. So you get an idea, get a feel for what the questions are like and the flavor of the questions. And they want to know here, what's the definition of an amateur station? And they of course, are pointing to the fourth item as the correct answer, a station in the amateur radio service used for radio communications. Back in those days, you could use the term of the thing you were trying to describe as part of your definition. Next slide. So another question from the question pool. What's the transmission call that disturbs other communications? And if you've done your homework, you know it's not interrupted carrier wave. You know it's not transponder signals, and you know it's not unidentified transmissions, but harmful interference. Okay, now we're going to move on to the methods of communications, and this is in sub-element 2. Was there a question? Okay. All right, here's your first piece of technology. Just a little dip into technology. You should be looking at a picture of alternating and direct current. The green line, of course, is going to be your direct current line. There's no oscillations there. We are looking at a scale, the orange line being zero. We're measuring voltage. This particular green line is in the plus range, so this is a plus voltage. We're not too concerned about how much it is right now. It's merely we want to draw your attention to the difference between alternating current and direct current. The straight line across indicates it is a non-oscillating. It is 12 volts all the time. The wave that you're looking at there, which is really one cycle, is alternating current. Alternating current meaning that the voltage first rises to a peak in the positive range and then cycles down through zero into the negative range and then back up again. And you'll find out as we go on in the training that this cycle is the basis for frequency, and everything is built upon that. So we will be talking about 12 volts DC, but we'll also be talking about alternating current. This alternating current becomes the basis for radio frequencies. Next slide. Relationship of frequency and wavelength. Remember up front we talked about meters, 80 meters. Well, now you can start to see a little bit of the connection between meters and cycles per second. In this case, you can see the measurement in time for one cycle, the rise, the fall, and then the rise again to the zero line, starting at the zero line, crossing the zero line, and back up to the zero line is one cycle. The time it takes for that one cycle to travel, the distance to travel and that during the time of that one cycle is what wavelength is all about. We're going to go into that much deeper, but just try and hold that thought. Distance, wavelength, time, and the number of cycles to travel that distance is going to become your relationship to frequency. Next slide. So now, we're going to talk about frequency a little bit. Frequency now is going to be defined as a measure of the number of times or cycles per second. How many times that voltage rises, crosses the zero line, and comes back up? How many of those cycles per second an alternating current flows back and forth? That's going to become frequency. The basis or standard unit of frequency is called the hertz. 1 hertz is the same as saying 1 cycle. Why do we have hertz? I think he's the guy that invented this concept. It was not called hertz when I took my test. It's called hertz now. Extra credit for anybody who wants it. Find out whether this fellow that figured out frequency is in any way related to the folks that rent cars today. So down at the bottom you see 60 hertz means 60 cycles per second. That's exactly right. Of course 60 cycles per second is what you have coming from your power station that goes to your house that provides electricity for all your appliances. Our standard here in the United States for alternating current is 60 cycles per second. All right, next slide. A little bit more on frequency. A radio frequency wave is an electromagnetic oscillation or cycle that repeats more than 20,000 times per second. RF waves travel at the speed of light. All right, so if you are listening to your stereo and you have a really good one, you're going to be able to hear frequencies, audio frequencies, from maybe 15 cycles, 20, 30, 40 cycles of very low rumbly sounds, all the way up to maybe 15,000 cycles per second, maybe 18,000 very high frequencies that you might hear. Once you get past 19,000 and start getting into 20,000 cycles per second, one thing, you can't hear that anymore. Some animals can hear up in that range. As you start getting a little bit higher than that, what happens is that those sound waves become something different. They become electromagnetic waves. You'll see more about that down the road here. So an audio frequency signal, again, is an electromagnetic oscillation or cycle that repeats between 20 to 20,000 times per second. Audio frequency. A really great stereo will have specs like that. A really great microphone will have specs like that. Sound waves are not electromagnetic waves. That's probably going to be on the test. Next slide. All right, now here's another depiction for you because we're going to be talking about wavelength. So we want to show you the difference between long wave or low frequencies and short wave, which is the HF or high frequencies ranges. The distance an AC signal travels in one complete cycle is its wavelength. One complete cycle starts at zero, goes up to its high point, then voltage down to zero again, down to the minus point and back to zero. One cycle. that distance wavelength. As the frequency increases, the wavelengths get shorter. That's why when we talk about 2.4 gigahertz, we're talking about 13 centimeters in wavelength. 13 centimeters is a very short wavelength. That's why the antennas are so small. When you talk about AM broadcast, you're talking about 2 megahertz, maybe 200 meters. Okay, 200 meters. Guess what? That's why those towers are so tall, because they have to create a structure that will oscillate at that wavelength. So that's driving down the road. You see the 600-foot tower. You can pretty much guess that that is a, if it's an AM tower, that that's operating around the 200 meter wavelength. When you look at your rooftop, when you have your new satellite antenna up there, and it's so tiny, it's almost like an acorn. Now you're talking ultra high frequencies, very short wavelength, very tiny antenna. Next slide. It actually is a graph of the spectrum that we're most familiar with today. And you can take a look at that, and you will see how it starts out at 30 cycles per second, or in this case it's labeled 30 hertz. And the first bar at the top goes from 30 hertz all the way up to 3 million hertz per second. And then it jumps to the next bar graph, which is 300 gigahertz, ultra high frequency, and microwaves, in fact. So from sound, we go to radio waves. From radio waves, you go down to the next and the last bar. We go from radio waves to visible light. And then from visible light, right into ultraviolet light, and then x-rays, and then gamma rays. It's all radiation from radio waves on. The radio waves are considered low-level radiation, but it is still radiation, man-made radiation. When you get up to the x-rays, these are things that come off the old TV set tubes, for example. There was a reason why our parents said, don't sit so close to the TV set. It's because the way those pictures are painted on the screen, there's an X-ray gun there on the back of the tube that is spraying and heating up the phosphorus that's painted on the back of that TV screen. And some of those X-rays are continuing to pass through that screen, so you want to get back from that a little bit. That's what that was all about. And then, of course, you get up to your gamma rays, where you're talking about radiation from nuclear devices and radioactive substances. So spend some time looking at that chart. Get comfortable with it. I don't know if there'll be anything on the test specifically about that. They will probably ask you about very high frequency, VHF, UHF, because that's the meat for the technician class. All right, so now a little bit of math here, not too much. We're talking about wavelength formula, and to convert from frequency to wavelength. Pretty easy, write it down, try it out. Go back to the chart and compare your answers to the chart. You should be able to pick a frequency, put it into that little formula there, and come out with wavelength, and then compare it to the chart. Next slide. Radio frequency. A radio frequency may be identified by its wavelength, its corresponding frequency, the radio band in which it's transmitted or received. Medium frequency for MF, high frequency for HF, very high, and ultra high. might be on the test. Next slide. Harmonics. Now, this is a term you haven't heard. The frequency of a harmonic is exactly two or three or more times the desired frequency. So, let's say I am transmitting on 400 megahertz. And I have a receiver that is listening on 800 megahertz. If my transmitter has a second harmonic, I'm going to be able to hear that 400 megahertz transmission on my 800 megahertz receiver, because it will be tuned to the second harmonic. Harmonics are going to be very important down the road, especially when you get into HF operations and antennas. In the case of transmitting, you want to have a significant limitation on your harmonics. And the reason is that some of the amateur bands are harmonics of lower frequency bands that are being used. So if you're operating on 80 meters and your transmitter is not adjusted properly, you could be interfering with other radio operators that are operating on, say, 40 meters or 20 meters. Just do the math. You can see where multiplying your frequency by 2 or by 3, there are certain areas where that second or third harmonic would show up in another licensed spectrum, and you don't want to be causing interference to folks. So it's important to make sure your transmitters are working properly. On the antenna side of things, harmonics can be a value, because rather than putting up an antenna for each band, you might be able to operate one antenna on its second and third harmonic. And they call these types of antennas multi-band antennas. And a lot of folks have spent a lot of energy designing antennas because it really is a great cost savings if you just have one feed line and one antenna. You'll learn a lot more about that down the road. Just keep those two thoughts in mind. Harmonics are not good on transmitters, and they can be useful on antennas. Next slide. It's our first picture of a carrier wave on what we call an oscilloscope. Basic principle of radio communications is combining a radio wave with an information signal and transmitting it. That's the fundamental mission of radio. You have a carrier wave, and the carrier wave has information. I was thinking about that and thought to myself, perhaps the reason they called it a carrier wave is because it was carrying the data, carrying the information. So when you combine a signal, an information signal with a radio signal, you have something called modulation. The picture on the right-hand side is a modulated carrier. The picture on the left-hand side is unmodulated, or a carrier wave. Right-hand side, modulated carrier wave. All right, so there's information there. And if you have a receiver with a detector, it will be able to separate the carrier wave from the information signal and take that information and present it to your speaker so you can hear what that information is. And there will be different types of modes of operation, single sideband, which you'll learn about, frequency modulation, AM modulation, and all those are types of a signal that is carried by the radio wave. All right, next slide, FCC emission types. There you go. As this one is building up on your screens, you will see CW, which stands for carrier wave, and then something called phone. Well, everybody today is going to think, well, that must mean telephone. No, it doesn't mean telephone. In the old days, mid-century, when they talked about voice transmission, they described that emission type as a phone transmission. And when they issued the licenses, and this is still the case today, they're described as the CW portion of the band where you operate CW only, and then there is a phone portion of the band where you operate voice. We have three types of voice modulations right now. AM for amplitude modulation, like you hear on your AM broadcast radio. Single sideband modulation, which you will learn about. Just remember, SSB is the designation acronym for single sideband modulation. And then there is FM, which you also hear on your FM radio, and that is frequency modulation. If we listen to an FM transmission like this one.
I was told you could take that and program in the 220 and work it in the 220.
I don't know.
That's a 2-meter FM transmission. And if we want to hear a sideband transmission, let's see if we can find a sideband signal here.
What do you see here? I hear the ping pong table getting warmed up here next door. You know, since Mike's been home, the ping pong table's been getting a workout here. All his buddies been coming over. I've been playing with them a little bit, but a little background noise there. I'm not gonna talk about anything.
All right, so that's an example of a sideband signal. I tuned off the frequency for a little bit so you could hear what it sounds like, a little bit like Donald the Duck there when you're not tuned in. We also have data transmissions. Again, and back in the old days, there was something called RTTY or teletype, and then there is something today called PSK31. And we do have some other types of data transmissions, so telemetry, telecommand, or computer communications. So, unfortunately, on the lower frequencies, there's not enough bandwidth to do a lot of computer communications. But as you go up into those higher ultra-high and super ultra-high frequencies, of course, you can run some pretty high-speed data. Okay, next slide is phone emissions. The FCC calls all types of voice transmissions phone. Someone has got some AC on their phone right now. Oh, they're gone. Frequency modulated, again, phone is most often used for VHF and UHF in the FM mode, which is absolutely right. Upper sideband phone is commonly used on the 10-meter phone band. That's probably going to be on the test. Sounds like a great test question. And then upper sideband phone is normally used for VHF, UHF sideband communications. So it looks like upper sideband is used a lot as you go up in frequency. So something to consider. My guess is you might see more than one question on the test for that. Okay. Data emissions. FCC calls telemetry, telecommand, and computer communications data emissions. Some common data emissions are PSK31 and radio teletype. Let me tell you a little bit about PSK31. It is a fairly slow 31 baud. All right. so that folks who might be interested to know that baud and bits per second are not the same. 250 baud means there's 250 signals that are transmitted in 1 second. 250 signals. That's what you're measuring when someone gives you a baud rate. If each signal has 4 bits of information, then it's going to be equivalent to 1,000 bits per second. That's how you get bits per second. So remember that. 250 signals per second is your baud, and then depending on the number of bits, you multiply that times your baud rate to get your bits per second. All right, when using packet, the term connected means sending data to only one receiving station and it replies the data is being received correctly. Technician licenses are permitted to operate point-to-point digital message forwarding in the 219 to 220 megahertz range. Another great multiple question that may come up in the test. Okay, next slide. The technician class with Morse code, and we're going to try to finish up quickly here because I don't want to keep you more than an hour. If you have your technician class with Morse code, you're allowed to operate only CW from this portion of the band, 7100 to 7150. You'll have to memorize these things. There's no way around it. There's no formula to figure it out. Every band is a little bit different. So take a look at this page, and these are all things you just have to memorize. The power output, 250 watts, peak envelope power. PEP stands for peak envelope power. Frequency privileges on 10 meters limited to 28.1 to 28.5 megahertz, and you have frequency limitations on 80 meters as well. So this is where you can operate CW if you get your CW endorsement when you test. Next slide. Great, we're not too far over our time limit here. This is your homework slide. Study sub-elements T1 and T2 of the question pool. If you have your Now You're Talking book, it's in there. Get familiar with it, go over it, read it a couple times. The idea is to get familiar with the terminology, and we're going to have a class every week, and so that at the end of the 5 weeks, you'll be able to take your tests, and this stuff will be fresh in your mind. And also, you want to read chapters 1 and 2. And next week, you will have a different instructor, and we appreciate you tuning in this evening, and hopefully you're well on your way to getting your technician license. Any questions?
Dave, is the elements T1 and T2 of the question pool, is that in the book?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yep, great. You should be in good shape.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Desiree, anybody else? All right, that concludes our Unit 1 training for technician class license. And thank you all for participating, and we'll look forward to hearing from you next week. I'll send out another reminder so everybody knows, but typically we're looking for Thursday nights, 7:30 p.m. That's it for now. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Dave.
Welcome.
Thank you, Dave.
Good night.
Okay.